children widen the circle of our being in ways that are endless. Every baby that's born connects us to our own history, to our own parents and our grandparents and unknown forebears who brought new life into the world in each successive generation. Every baby that's born connects us to the future, to a world yet to come that belongs to our descendants, to our posterity, for whom we hold this world in trust, but whom we will never know. Every child connects us to nature, to the innocence and exuberance of a world that's always hatching pups and kittens and lambs and babes and newborns. Each child reminds us of the kinship we share with people of other races and lands and cultures, those who love their young ones as purely, as tenderly as we do. Each child connects us to the universe, to the holy mysteries of birth and death and becoming, from which we all emerge, to which we all return. Children widen the circle of our being in ways that are endless. It's not the things you wear, it's not the way you do your hair, but it's you I like. The way you are right now, the way down deep inside you. Not the things that hide you, not your toys, they're just beside you. But it's you I like. Every part of you, your skin, your eyes, your feelings, whether old or new, I hope that you'll remember, even when you're feeling blue, that it's you I like. It's you, yourself. It's you. It's you I like. Let's join in meditation. Maybe it's too much to ask or demand that we love our neighbor, but help us to like them a little more. And like ourselves a little bit better too. Find something good to appreciate in our often flawed human nature. And see the best in others. To judge them as we ourselves would want to be judged, not for our failings and imperfections, but for our aspirations and our good intentions. To see them as the children they once were, not saints, and certainly not sinners, but just kids, being kids, doing the best they can. say the words television preacher, probably brings some images to mind. Depends on your generation, Pat Robertson or Oral Roberts or guys like Joel Osteen, who preaches his gospel of success and prosperity out of the rocket dome. The guy who closed the doors to his church when Houston was flooded with refugees, desperate after Hurricane Harvey. My guess is the phrase a TV preacher conjures up some images of a certain amount of unctuous piety and self-righteousness, along with a generous dollop of good old-fashioned greed. But there's at least one TV preacher who does not fit that mold at all. He broadcasts every day into more households than Billy Graham could reach in the course of a whole crusade. In an era when many congregations, including this one, worry that they are growing older, wondering if they can find a language to speak to the coming generation, he's able to talk to the youngest of the young. And of course, I mean Fred Rogers of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, who, as an ordained Presbyterian minister, had the biggest congregation in the country, and who still broadcasts to millions of children every morning. Mr. Rogers passed away 15 years ago, but he lives on through the magic of reruns, and although it can be a little bit creepy watching him on the screen singing, "You know, it's good just to be alive," he's become even more iconic, even more popular after his passing. A new biopic featuring Tom Hanks titled "You Are My Friend" is going to be in theaters next year. And the U.S. Postal Service issued a commemorative stamp this year to celebrate the 50th anniversary of his first broadcast back in February of 1968. Appropriately, this is a forever stamp. I didn't grow up with Mr. Rogers. I grew up watching Captain Kangaroo, probably. I see a lot of Captain Kangaroo fans out there, but if you're like me, you probably fondly remember Mr. Green Jeans and Bunny Rabbit. This all suggests that what we watch as kids really has a lasting formative influence on us as viewers. I don't remember much of my high school chemistry, but I do remember Mr. Moose. And that may be why Bob Keeshan, Captain Kangaroo himself, called Fred Rogers the patron saint of children's TV. It was Dory, my wife, who first introduced me to Mr. Rogers and made me consider all that the neighborhood had to offer. This was almost 30 years ago. We had just moved to New England. We had a brand new family. Both our kids were under 12 months old. Our son Noah had just been born in Korea about the same time Dory got pregnant. And in the great diaper debate of those days, we chose a cloth over disposable as being more environmentally correct. And so we contracted with a service to deliver 168 dieties to our home every week, one for every hour of the day and night, 24/7. This was a challenging time for us. For a while, Dory, she tried to keep up the practice of law But she found that being married to a workaholic minister, this was more than any mother could reasonably manage. And we decided together that rather than trying to pay for daycare on the salary of a public defender, it would make a lot more sense for her just to stay home with the kids, which is what she did. It was a wise move, but it also had some unforeseen and unintended consequences. You know, previously when we've been at social events, people are making small talk. It's always, so what do you do? When she would tell people that she was a criminal defense attorney with a degree from Harvard, there was always a spark of interest there. When she would say, I'm a full-time mother and stay at home with the kids, people would look around the room, is there a more interesting conversation partner somewhere here? You know, being a homemaker and nurturer, caring for children, is not a role that's highly valued in our society. For her, it was hard sometimes to feel good about herself, who she was and what she was doing, and I have to apologize at times. You know, I was caught up in the demands of a new job. I was not always as supportive as I could have been. There was, though, at least one other adult in her life every day who was emotionally present, who she could count on for encouragement when she was feeling low. Mr. Rogers, she said, liked her, just the way she was. Of course, you know, I like Mr. Rogers because he was a vegetarian, and he went to bed every night at 9:30, just like me. And we have the same good taste in clothes, but those are all externals, and it was what was inside a person that he cared about. When Mr. Rogers said that he liked you, you felt that he was being truthful, even though you knew that he was talking to a mass audience of stressed moms and hyperactive tots. There didn't seem to be a phony bone in his lanky, almost 6-foot-tall frame. By all accounts, he was the same person. He had the same manner on or off camera. And that's why Fred Rogers was always careful to call his productions programs rather than shows. He was not a showman. He was not an entertainer. He was never putting on an act in any way. You know, a lot of the kiddie fair out there has subtle or not so subtle undertones of manipulation. Barney, the purple dinosaur, he always seemed to envelop his audience in a cocoon of warm fuzziness where no negative feelings were allowed. I love you, you love me, we're a happy family. And then there was, still is, Sesame Street, with its razzle-dazzle of animation, high energy, high tech, endless recitation of the alphabet, putting people into a video-induced trance of reading readiness as though watching TV were really the best way to prepare kids for the written page, as though singing rap lyrics was really going to teach them math. Only Mr. Rogers seemed to really take the time to communicate with children, which involved listening as much as talking. As he said, the question is not what can we sell children and families who use Mr. Rogers' neighborhood, not even what can we give them, but who are they? Who are they? And what are they bringing to the television set? And what kids bring are often weighty concerns. You know, being small does not mean that you don't have big problems. Topics like divorce and loneliness and what it was like to use an electric wheelchair, these were all grist for the mill on Mr. Rogers' neighborhood. One example is how gently and truthfully he would address the issue of death when the goldfish that he took care of every day on his program died. He told the children exactly what had happened, that the fish would not be coming back, that they could bury it together and say goodbye, and that the fish could always be a memory. It's important because children do not have the same intellectual equipment we do. They can't conceptualize endings in the way we do, but they have all the same emotions. I know this because my own children got goldfish when they were kids. We were at the county fair, and they insisted on tossing ping pong balls on one of the sideshows into empty fish bowls to win a free goldfish. And of course, I was not in favor of this at all. You know, you shouldn't be parceling out living creatures as prizes on the midway. But it was their money, and of course, they won, each of them, a free fish. And by the time we'd purchased all the tanks and nets and food and other paraphernalia, these free fish cost me plenty. To me, they were mostly an annoyance. And true to my predictions, in spite of our best efforts to keep them going, they expired, both of them, after a few days, and we put them in the ground under little crosses out in the backyard near the clothesline. But what surprised me was how our children continued to ruminate about those fish for months afterwards. You know, all the journals that our daughter did in school were filled with pictures of Rosie, which was the pet name she gave to all her favorite dolls and playmates. And in a little autobiographical essay that our son wrote almost a year later, the fish received far more ink than grandparents or Sunday school or sports or things that I thought would have been more important in his life. I walked out one evening the next spring to hang up the clothes. I found two little apple blossoms on their graves. For me, the fish were a nuisance, but you know, for the children, they were something big. They were symbols of the great mystery of birth and death and life and loss and transience and transcendence. And it's this respect for children's inner worlds, their inner lives, that made Mr. Rogers such an appealing figure when he would sing his song, "It's You I Like." He sensed his affection, his reverence for every child as an expression of something more. I think this was the essence of his theology, and it's one I share. I mean, I wiped too many bottoms. I adjudicated too many backseat arguments to idealize children. I don't sentimentalize them, but I'm also enough of a soft-hearted dad to think that sometimes when we hold them in our arms, it's as close as we come to cradling the holy. One holiday, for instance, I put my Christmas list up on the refrigerator, and it wasn't an extravagant list. You know, I wanted some I wanted some warm socks and a new serving spoon for the kitchen, and I wanted a bird book. Nothing big, but there were like three or four other things on the list. And then I saw that my children had put up their lists next to mine. And their lists were just as long, but their lists were all things that they wanted to give to other people.
Oh.
I didn't teach them that. They didn't inherit that from me. I don't know where they got that. It came from someplace higher, maybe from watching so much Mr. Rogers. He didn't call his message preaching. I never wanted to superimpose anything on anybody, he offered modestly. I'd like to think I can create some sort of atmosphere that allows people to be comfortable with who they are, and consequently they can grow from there. And maybe this is how the eternal comes into our lives. It's not coming in from the outside, but just enabling us to feel safe enough to grow into our own possibilities. One of the biggest influences on his own growing, Rogers said, was his own mom when he was young, and would read the headlines, watch the news, and he would see awful things like the things we saw this week, shootings and wars and natural disasters. His mom would always say, look for the helpers. There are always going to be people helping. Another big teacher for him was the professor who taught him Greek at the Pittsburgh Theological Seminary, where he went to classes for 8 years as a part-time student while he was also working at WQED on the Children's Corner, which was his first venture into TV ministry. And the main insight that he got from his Greek professor, Dr. Orr, was that in this life, evil takes the form of the accuser, while goodness acts as the advocate. And this is the illustration that he gave, which resonates with me. He was going to a church service. Church was probably fancier than this one. You know, it was a Presbyterian church. It was back in the 50s, but he was attending as a visitor along with his wife and some friends. We were on vacation, he explained, and I was in the middle of my homiletics course at the time. Homiletics is the class that, if you're a seminary student, is supposed to teach you, you know, eloquence in the pulpit. So he was taking his homiletics course, and during the sermon he says, I kept ticking off every mistake I thought the preacher was making. He must have been 80 years old. And when this interminable sermon finally ended, I turned to my friend intending to say something critical, and I saw tears running down her face. She whispered to me, he said exactly what I needed to hear. This was a turning moment for me, he affirmed. I was judging, and she was needing. And this is how the Holy Spirit comes to us, not in our judgment, but in our need. It's chastening when I think of how often I'm critical rather than appreciating the people around me. But the best part of ourselves isn't that part that looks down. The best part isn't the part that looks down, it's the part that gets down, that lowers itself, that even kneels the way we naturally get down on a child's level. to share, to listen to that child, to his or her concerns, who wants to tell us about their day or who needs a hug. And it's from that posture of simplicity that healing comes into our lives. There's a German theologian, Friedrich Schleiermacher. This is another of the reasons you go to seminary, so you can throw out these names like Friedrich Schleiermacher. He once defined religion as the feeling of absolute dependence. It makes sense if I think of a child. You know, there's no being in the world more dependent than a child. And their needs are so obvious. They need to be fed. They need to be sheltered. They need to be tucked in at night and read a story. And all of us have those needs, those dependencies, those tender yearnings, even though we try and put up a front of self-reliance. But it's said that it's in becoming like little children that we come closest to the beloved community. When he was the commencement speaker at Yale some years ago, Rogers encountered one of the undergraduates who told him how important it had been watching him every day on public television, and how Mr. Rogers' neighborhood, especially the land of make-believe, came closest to his idea of what heaven might be like. And I suppose that's why so many continue to watch, because maybe for at least a half an hour a day we can find a little bit of that unconditional love and acceptance that heaven's all about. It's not just a make-believe place, it's a real place. The connections we make in the course of a lifetime, Mr. Rogers said, the connections we make, maybe that's what's heaven is. And he could be right.